Ever dream of a three-row SUV where everything for every passenger feels just right? Introducing the all-new Infiniti QX80. With available features like biometric cooling, electronic air suspension, and segment-first individual audio that isolates sound right to the driver's seat. Discover every just-right feature in the all-new QX80 at InfinitiUSA.com. 2025 QX80 is not yet available for purchase. Expected availability summer 2024. Individual audio cannot buffer all interior sounds. See owner's manual for details.
We all know about the speed of sound, but have you ever thought about the sounds of speeding? If you drive over the speed limit, there are lots of different sounds you might hear. Drive too fast and you can hear the sound of your vehicle crashing, the sound of ambulances and first responders desperately trying to free you from the wreckage. You can hear the beeps of a heart monitor. You can hear doctors and nurses in an emergency room as you're being treated for your injuries. You can hear the sound of your worried family members in the hospital waiting room, hoping to hear that you're okay. You could even hear the sound of people crying at a funeral. Because if you drive over the speed limit, whether by a lot or by a little, you could do damage that's beyond repair. You could seriously injure yourself. Or worse, you could hurt and even kill someone else. When you speed, you put everyone on the road in danger. One way or another, speeding catches up with you. Paid for by NHTSA.
Hello, survivalists. This is The Crux, True Survival Stories, and I'm your host, Casey McIntosh, joined by Julie Henningsen. Hello, Julie.
Hey, Casey. How are you doing? I'm excited to hear what you have in store for us today.
I hope you're still excited later on partway through the story, because it's a little bit more of a tragedy than a survival story. There is a little survival. There's a little bit more tragedy.
Okay. Well, thanks for the forewarning.
Yeah. I kind of feel like I'm pulling a Julie because there's so many stories that we've done where you're like, this is a little bit of a downer, just so you know.
Hey, as long as someone survives, I think it's a survival story in my book anyway. So you're all good.
Right. Today we're talking about the tragedy at Kufra, which took place in May 1942 during World War II. 11 of 12 South African air crew members flying three Bristol Blenheim Mark V aircrafts from No. 15 Squadron of the South African Air Force perished from thirst and exposure in the Sahara Desert.
Oh, this sounds like a good one. It sounds familiar. The desert, World War II. We've talked a lot about both of those things.
Right.
Tell me more.
This tragedy occurred after some navigational errors during a routine flight, and they became lost near the oasis of Kufra in Libya, and it resulted in forced landing in the unforgiving desert. So hang on with us if you're not a history buff. I'm telling you, this is chilling, despite the fact that the temperatures were not so chilling in the Sahara Desert when this took place. But it's just a bunch of near misses and just heartbreaking, honestly. And a story that I'm frankly surprised I've not heard of before. I just kind of stumbled across this story and was just captivated by how terrifying the experience must have been for these soldiers. This takes place during World War II. The South African aircrew members were part of the North African campaign, where Allied forces, including the South African Air Force, teamed up against the Axis power in the region. So the campaign involved the US, UK, Free French forces, and Commonwealth countries, which included New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, and India, who were taking on Germany and Italy, who are the Axis forces. Okay, so Axis is the, you know, the bad guys, and the Allied forces are the good guys.
Which is something, you know, we learn in history class, but it's funny, I never really think of South Africa or some of these smaller countries that probably played a smaller, relatively smaller role as part of the Allied forces, but they're certainly there.
For sure. And North Africa was a critical battleground for both sides due to some strategic elements. And this is something that I wasn't aware of. We had mentioned this on the episode about Eddie Rickenbacker, because he was bringing some information to General MacArthur.
That's right. About an operation that was going to occur in North Africa. Maybe this was it.
Well, you know, I don't know how that plays into the story. I didn't get into the weeds too much about that. But the whole importance of this was that the Allied forces need to control the area because of access to the Suez Canal. And that was essential for British supply routes into the Middle Eastern oil fields. But it also offered a potential launch point for invading Southern Europe. So in the event that the bad guys, the Axis powers, get in there, then they have another stronghold. And so they needed to get in there and protect that area and prevent the Axis powers from getting in through that route. Well, what we could call it is a geographical artery. It's basically got major blood flow to another area. It's a point of entry for, you know, potentially pathogens to hop in, and they're trying to prevent the spread of disease. How about that?
I love the physiology anatomy. The Suez Canal is a major artery.
You're right. Exactly. The Kufra Oasis is located in the southeastern Libyan desert within the Sahara, and that is where the critical base is, just because there's basically some respite from the desert in the Kufra Oasis. So again, if the Allies didn't hold on to Kufra, the Axis forces could use Kufra as a launch pad for attacks on the Nile Valley, threatening the entire Middle East and crucial supply routes from Egypt to West Africa. So the South African air crew were heading towards Kufra for a couple reasons. Number one, they were going there for strategic importance. They're trying to protect that area. They're doing reconnaissance missions. They have supply routes. They're staging areas for military operations. And then secondly, they're there for Allied support. The South African Air Force 15 Squadron was part of the broader Allied effort to control North Africa. And they were going to be carrying out reconnaissance. They're doing bombing runs. They're supporting ground troops in the air. That was the point. And this all proved to be a worthwhile venture because the Allies did prevail and they were able to hold that. They were able to protect that bloodline to the Suez Canal.
Nice.
Thereby
kept
preventing
that artery intact.
Exactly. Now we're going to get more into the details of our specific story. The South African Air Force 15 Squadron, they left South Africa in January of 1942 for Kufra to support the Allied forces. And they arrived in Egypt before that in February 1942. There were two men out of the squadron who had experience in desert operations. And those men were Lieutenant Colonel H.H. Borkenhagen and Captain J.L.V. DeWitt. They were ordered to support the Allied forces in the Oasis of Kufra, which is, again, is in the Libyan desert. They were going to offer, again, air defense and support. There was a ground crew of 47 men headed to Kufra arriving April 8, 1942. And Major DeWitt had just been promoted to major. He was in command of this operation. He flew to Wadi Haifa to make arrangements, and then he was escorted to Kufra with the ground party, and it took 1 week to reach their destination, which I would imagine was probably not the most fun or exciting of transports through the desert.
Yeah, I know. I agree. That probably was not the best journey to be on.
No, you're probably just eating dust the entire time. So the 15th Squadron chose three of the best Blenheims, which are planes, for the detachment. And each of these Blenheims carried a four-man crew. They arrived at Kufra on April 1942. It was May 3rd, 1942, and Major DeWitt was briefing his crews on the first flight, which was a familiarization flight that he was planning on leading first thing in the morning on May 4. Basically, he's trying to get these men comfortable flying in the desert, because remember, only two of the entire group had any desert experience. And he wants mm-hmm. them to get familiar with landmarks, potential battle zones, you know, just get the lay of the land essentially from the air.
Yeah, literally probably the lay of the land. Yeah,
right.
Training.
And they're going to be supporting the ground crew, so they just need to generally know the area. They planned on flying in a square path. The first leg would be 83 miles or 134 kilometers from Kufra to Rabiana, Libya. The second leg is only 51.5 miles or 82.9 kilometers. The third leg was 64 miles or 103 kilometers. And finally, the last leg was 83.5 mile leg back to Kufra. So the flight was going to be made at a speed of 150 miles an hour, which is 240 kilometers an hour. Therefore, we can conclude that the entire flight of 282 miles at 150 miles an hour should only take an approximate time of 1 hour and 53 minutes.
Oh, very good math. You came up with that quick.
Well, it wasn't off the top of my head, so there you go. I was just curious. I was wondering, like, how long is this flight supposed to take them? Major DeWitt was planning on being back, you know, before lunch on that day. On the morning of May 3rd, the non-commissioned officer overseeing the Kufra point-to-point radio station conducted tests on the aircraft's radio equipment to confirm that the frequencies and the reception was optimal and it was operational and everything was going to be fine for communication. Ground crews meticulously inspected the aircrafts. They confirmed the overall serviceability of these aircrafts. They verified the quantities of fuel, oil, water, rations, and each aircraft was equipped with two containers carrying 7.5 gallons or 37 liters of water and sufficient rations for 4 days. Additionally, each crew member was required to carry 2 filled water bottles, providing an extra 2 quarts or 2.5 liters of liquid per person. All this to say is that it's not like this was just a fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants operation without any consideration for potential adverse event.
Yeah, they were following the 7 P's that we like to promote here on the podcast.
Prior proper planning. I will say that there's a difference between having the things that you need and using them appropriately. And then there's also a difference between having the things that you need and actually thinking or discussing potential consequences of poor decision making, right? Like in the event that something happens, what are you doing? What is the plan, right? So you can have all the prior proper planning, but if you don't know what to do in the event of an emergency, it doesn't really help you out all that much, which is sort of the case in this story.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons why we always talk about how don't put anything in your first aid kit that you don't know how to use. There's a lot of flashy, you know, cool products you can buy out there. But if you don't know how to use it in the event of an emergency, then don't waste your energy carrying it around. Or right. Get training in how to use it.
Yeah, get training in one of Julie's classes.
Headwatersfieldmedicine.com.
That's
come
right.
Come see us in Montana and we'll train you up.
We'll show you what's up. So on May 4, 1942, the temperature in Kufra, Libya was typical for the region, an average high temperature around 30.6 degrees Celsius or 87.1 degrees Fahrenheit, and potentially reaching upwards towards 36.5 degrees Celsius or 97.7 degrees Fahrenheit. In the morning, they received a weather report with a predicted visibility of 2.5 miles or 4.0 kilometers, a wind speed of 19 to 24 miles per hour at 1,600 feet. A weather balloon to check for wind conditions was offered but declined by Major DeWitt. A weather balloon is a balloon that's sent into the stratosphere with instruments to monitor weather conditions. This decision that Major DeWitt made came back to haunt him later because the weather reading that they had from earlier was not consistent with the weather when they took off. The Blenheim crews each had, again, 4 men on board. And the Blenheims on this mission, which I don't expect you to remember specifically, but the names of these individual aircrafts were Z7513, Z7610, and T2252. Unfortunately, they don't give these aircrafts really cool names because that would be way more fun and easier to remember. So I don't know what to say about that, but that was my thought. You know, everything is a number.
Right. Yeah. Boring.
Boring.
Why not name them Pedro, Jeb, and Napoleon.
Pedro, Deb, and Napoleon. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
So Pedro, Deb, and Napoleon took off from Kufra after the initial communications. Nothing was heard from them in regard to their flight until 7:10 a.m. I don't know what time they initially took off. The crews were under the impression that they had completed their flight successfully. They had identified each of the waypoints and expected to return back between 7:33 and 7:42. And there were Allied personnel at Ribiana, which is the end of the first leg. They never heard the plane fly overhead, which indicates that they were already off course from the time that they thought their first leg was completed.
And so I'm just so curious, because this is 1942, like, how are they navigating?
Well, they're navigating using coordinates, and they also have navigators. There's each one of these crews has a navigator on board.
Who's using some kind of, like, rudimentary instrument to
calibrate. Right. And so they take draft readings, which refer to measurements of air pressure around the aircraft during flight. And those readings are crucial for pilots to understand aerodynamic conditions the plane is encountering. And they also help in maintaining optimal flight parameters, such as airspeed, altitude, and stability, and also can provide important information about weather conditions and turbulence.
It's just so interesting. And traveling that distance, it's almost surprising if they would make it. I don't know, to me.
I know.
It's surprising if they would make it to their destination that accurately without, you know, some of the reliable technology that we have today. It just, like many things, makes you think, how did they do that back before the information age?
I think that the experience level was really paramount in these situations. The person who's leading needs to really know that they're going in the right direction, right? I'm sure that they're using degrees and coordinates to figure out where am I, what direction am I going, and how long do I need to be going in this direction based upon the airspeed that I'm going at, right? That's, it's very rudimentary, but, you know, all it takes is a couple degrees of inaccurate direction to end up in the middle of absolutely nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even a fraction of a degree off,
you know, and thereby the importance of knowing how to navigate based upon what you see on the ground and being familiar with the area in general, which I don't know if Major DeWitt, who was in command, if he had done any flying in that specific area before this happened. Did he get familiarized himself? And if so, who led him on that flight initially? You know what I mean? I didn't see anything about that when I was reading about this. So in any case, like I mentioned, they're already off course from the very, very beginning. And the initial report was incorrect. And instead of 19 to 24 mile an hour winds, they're actually blowing 31 miles an hour. And there was so much air turbulence that one of the navigators on the planes was having difficulty taking those draft readings. So the men thought they had reached their objective flight locations based upon timing, the coordinates that they had, the landmarks that they thought they visualized. The flight in their minds was successful, and they returned to Kufra. Actually, they were able to find their way back to Kufra, and they ended up having time to spare, so they decided to continue to fly.
Past Kufra.
Yes. Which, again, it's like all of these things where you could have been okay. Just like... And what follows is a tragic and disturbing tale of human error and failure, worsened by bad weather and technical problems.
Okay, people, let's talk about clustomers. A clustomer is what happens when marketers fail to personalize their marketing, grouping customers with different behaviors, different interests, motivators, purchase patterns, you name it, all into one tangled mess. But with MailChimp, marketers can untangle that mess using real-time behavior data to personalize every email you send. Turn clustomers into customers with Intuit MailChimp, the number one AI-powered email marketing and automation platform now with SMS.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Set against the daunting backdrop of the Sahara. However, the story also highlights incredible courage, perseverance, endurance, all of those things, and noble efforts made under these extreme circumstances. At 7:10 a.m., one of the aircrafts made contact with Kufra and requested a bearing. And Kufra, in turn, requested the transmission of dashes for directional finding. In this context, dashes is referring to Morse code signals consisting of short, rapid pulses used for communication via radio. In this case, Kufra requested the transmission of dashes from the Blenheim aircraft so that the direction finding station could establish the aircraft's bearings. By receiving these Morse code signals, the station could determine the direction from which the signals were coming and aid navigation coordination with the aircraft. So this is basically your backup plan if you get the coordinates wrong from the beginning, is that you call and they figure out where you are and then tell you where to go from there.
Okay.
But Kufra received no response. And at 7:27, Major DeWitt's Blenheim
Z7513 sought guidance for a return to Kufra. However, its radio operator ceased broadcasting before the direction-finding station could figure out where they were. Following a snap bearing, they heard, you know, a segment Kufra radioed instructions as 120-3 equals 0527. And this indicates a course of steer 120 degrees, zero wind, third class fix, time 05H27GMT, which for us non-pilots basically translates to directing the aircraft to steer at a specific compass headed 120 degrees, accounting for no wind effect, with a moderate navigational accuracy at a specific time. But unfortunately, even though the station was, you know, was able to partially communicate, the aircraft only received the numbers 305, which led them to believe that the course of base was 305 degrees.
Oh, shoot. Which is nowhere near.
Nowhere near.
120.
Right. Mm. And consequently, at 742, the aircraft turned to this course, flying past Allied infantrymen at Tizerbow to the west. And at 810, they reversed course to 125 degrees, the reciprocal bearing. And around 9 o'clock, the other Blenheim T-2252 starboard engine malfunctioned, prompted Major DeWitt to order a desert landing. Successfully, they landed at 9:15 a.m. The Blenheim crews got together. They figured out they were, or they thought, they were only 20 miles away or 32 kilometers away from Kufra. But in fact, they were absolutely, completely lost. And they didn't know where they were, and no one else knew where they were.
So this is just a timeout for my understanding, following each other.
Okay. Yep. All these three planes are flying together.
So they got lost on the first leg, but then you said they did make it back to Kufra. So even though they were lost, they did find their way back, but they just kept going. And they were like what line of sight following each other.
Yes.
Okay.
And so then the leading aircraft, which had Major DeWitt in it, was who requested a position.
Okay.
And he was leading the whole operation. So these other pilots are following him.
Okay, got it.
And then this aircraft, T-2252, the starboard engine goes down. And so that leads them to have to land and
all of them
figure
land.
Out, all of them together, figure out what do we do now.
Okay.
Yes. At 11 a.m., one crew hopped in Z7610. They headed southwest, but by 11:30, they were back without finding Kufra. So they went out and back. They tried again after siphoning some fuel from this disabled aircraft, T-2252, and they took off in the Z7610 at 11:40, and they aimed for about 24 miles on a 213-degree course, but again returned empty-handed by 11:40 a.m., and then at 3:35 p.m., a third attempt was made, cruising at 240 degrees, which actually would have taken them right back to Kufra. But they turned back after covering 81 miles, which should have taken them straight back to Kufra. But they turned back before they got there.
Oh, so close. What a bummer.
They were directly on course to make it back to Kufra. They turned back too soon because they must have assumed that it was closer than they thought. This is one of those instances where I feel like the reason that they made it back to Kufra in the beginning is because they had no reason not to have confidence in their directional abilities.
Right.
Right. And after you have multiple failed attempts, you just become more psychologically
ready to
defeated.
Give up. Yeah. Ready to give up too soon or not expecting the outcome that you hope for.
Right. Not to be too woo-woo-y or anything, but I mean, there is something to be said about positive expectations or negative expectations, and you have to wonder if it played a role.
Yeah, absolutely. You find what you're looking for, that's for sure.
Right. It's easy to overlook that or to forget that or just not to really believe it, but retrospectively, it seems like it is the case.
Yeah. And then the other thing I'll say about that that's interesting is, like when you're driving somewhere and you're like, where is this place? Shouldn't we be there yet? You know, every quarter mile seems like a mile. It just seems like you're going so far. But then let's say you finally find it. Now you're driving home. That same drive feels half the distance because you don't have so much anticipation.
Right.
And if you think about how slow time goes, if you're just looking at the clock and waiting for the minutes to pass, but additionally, these men knew they only had a certain amount of fuel in their tanks. And I'm sure that that was contributing to their feeling of anxiety about not finding Kupra. We only have so much gas or so much fuel. Are we going to make it?
And they probably want to have spare enough fuel to get back to the rest of the crew before they run out. So they're not kind of stranded in the desert in two separate parties.
Exactly. After these unsuccessful tries, the crew called off further searches for the day, thinking that help is probably on its way. They are assuming that everybody knows where they are. They're not worried at all. So presuming that they're going to be rescued imminently, they're drinking a lot of water. And by noon on May 4th, Kupra realized that the Blenheims must have landed somewhere in the desert because they didn't get back when anticipated. And they were getting sporadic weak signals from the plane, but it was just not enough to pinpoint their location. And ground search teams were sent out to Rebiana, Zima, and Landing Ground 007, which was one of the locations they were flying to. It's just named, you know, Landing Zone 007. Another really super fun name.
Yeah, real creative.
And various stations were keeping an ear out for any signals from the missing aircrafts. Ground searches started on shaky bearings, which were taken throughout the day. So whatever information they think they can obtain, they're trying to use it to find these aircrafts. On May 5th, the crews of the stranded Blenheims tried again to find Kupra, but they had no luck. They flew Z7513 using fuel from the aircraft that was no longer usable. And they first headed east for about 45 miles or 72 kilometers on a bearing of 90 degrees. And they came back without finding Kupra. They didn't give up. They took off again, this time flying 96 miles, 154 kilometers on a bearing of 290 degrees with three men aboard. Unfortunately, this time, this group of men ran out of fuel. They had to land 24 miles or 39 kilometers north of the other two stranded Blenheims.
Okay.
So now the crew is separated.
And there's three of them in that, the one that ran out of fuel.
Yeah. Right. So when the searchers ended up finding the Z7513 4 days later, they discovered evidence that suggested that that crew had landed twice during the flight but couldn't join the other planes, which was assumed because they ran out of fuel. Meanwhile, the ground search parties returned empty-handed. They realized that they needed to step up their efforts with an air search, which is a pretty obvious thing to consider. The stranded men assumed that since the Z7513 hadn't returned, it made it back to Kupra.
Yes, I bet they did. I bet that's what they were saying is if we don't come back, good news, we made it.
Yes, and this is a curse for sure.
Start drinking more water.
Right. Like, hey, we can do whatever we want because we know that we're going to be rescued soon.
Yeah.
In the evening, Major DeWitt and his men were firing pyrotechnic light cartridges and bursts from the turret guns to try to attract attention from anyone who might be searching for them. The men started at this point to really experience the pain that the desert could bring because there's intense heat. There's no shade for resting. And soon the wind picked up and before long, they were in the middle of a dust storm. And there's no cover here.
Yeah.
It is the middle of absolutely freaking nowhere. Just sand. There is nothing out here. It is desolate. You can't be in the aircraft. I'm sure it would just be like you're cooking in there.
Yeah.
You know, just like being inside of a car on a hot day.
Exactly.
So there's really nowhere to hide except for underneath the wing. By the morning of May 6th, which is day three, the nine men stranded with the Z7610 and the T2252, they had nearly run out of water. Major DeWitt issued the last water bottle. This is the morning of day three.
Mm.
And remember, the crews were supposed to have enough water for 4 days.
Wow.
In the desert, if rationed appropriately.
Right. They're having like water fights. They're like pouring it over their heads to cool off.
I bet they were. That's honestly, when I was just thinking about this at this point in the story, I was actually considering the fact that they may have done that.
Yeah.
You know, I was telling you about the race that I just ran in Missoula and like when the sprinkler's on. Okay. So it was 55 degrees. It's not even 90 something degrees. It's 55 degrees and cloudy. And I was running through sprinklers when I could.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know,
So you have to consider the fact that they may have done that if they thought they were going to be rescued at any minute.
Yeah, evaporative cooling. That's the surest way to avoid heat stroke, which is, I'm sure, something that was on their mind in that environment.
Yeah. So at this point, I think Major DeWitt was feeling a lot of pressure, and he decided to take matters into his own hands. He flew in the Z7610 to search for help. He headed west on a bearing of 290 degrees, and unfortunately, again, he returns empty-handed. Meanwhile, there's three Bristol Bombays from the Royal Air Force's number 216 Squadron setting out for an air search, hoping to spot the stranded Blenheims. However, they ran into fierce sandstorms that forced them to land, leaving them grounded for the next 2 days.
Oh, no.
It's just absolute terrible timing.
Yeah, bad to worse.
And the sandstorm only made things significantly worse for the men stranded with the Blenheims. And as the hours passed, some of them succumbed to the harsh conditions, just worsening their already dire situation. From May 7th through May 11th, this relentless sandstorm continued to wreak havoc on the stranded crew. And by May 8th, which is day 4, the visibility was starting to improve, but it also revealed the grim reality that only 6 out of the original 12 men were still alive.
Oh, no. So they couldn't even see each other. They weren't even, like, huddled together.
Maybe they were. The hard thing about a story from 1942 is that the documentation might be somewhat limited about the actual experience of these men, which is unfortunate, but we can anticipate that they probably were doing everything they could do to avoid the sand.
Yeah.
But what can you really do? You know, not a whole lot.
Right.
Major DeWitt, deeply concerned about the deteriorating situation, started to fear that the men might start turning on each other or maybe even him. And as the day wore on, he realized that he was one of only 3 survivors left.
Wow. So I wonder what these men are, like, what are they dying of? Heat, illness,
exposure. You know,
exposure. Yeah. If they had 3 days worth of water and we're only on, you know, day 7 or whatever it was.
Ready to get everyone else ready for back to school? You've got this, and Ollie's got you. Ollie Mood Supplements help you keep your cool and find your happy place. Try Hello Happy or Goodbye Stress so you don't sweat the small stuff. Take it all in stride and do wellness on your terms. Find Ollie at a Walmart or Target near you or at OLLY.com.
Ollie!
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
They're not dying of dehydration.
So this is day 4. By day 4. So you're right. It had only been 24 hours, I suppose, but I don't know what the water ration situation looked like in the initial few days of usage, because like we were mentioning, if they were using it to cool their bodies off by pouring it on their skin, that's not really helping hydrate you. You know, we don't really know. We know they use the water, but in what way, we don't know.
Right.
So I'm assuming that exposure, but also I'm sure dehydration, heat, I'm sure all of that played a role.
Yeah.
But also you're going to find some more things that will play a role that I'll give you some indication about later.
Oh.
Despite these ground search parties coming agonizingly close to the stranded Blenheims, I mean, within a couple of miles.
Ugh.
Even within sight of them.
Oh, no.
But their limited visibility prevented them from finding these downed aircrafts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the visibility was improving over time, but, like, you know, they were close. In his diary, Major DeWitt recorded, "Boys are going mad wholesale. They want to shoot each other. Very weak myself. Will I be able to stop them from shooting each other and stop them from shooting me? God give us strength. 6 of us left out of 12. No water. We expect to be all gone today. Death would be welcome. We went through hell." He later wrote, "Only me, Sergeant Shipman, and auto mechanic Jewel are still alive. We can't last if help does not arrive soon. They know where we are, but don't seem to do much about it. Bit of a poor show, isn't it? But we'll stick it out till the very end.
I wonder if they wanted to shoot each other to put each other out of their suffering.
I'm sure.
And maybe that is how some of them went, is they shot each other.
Right. I'm not going to go into too many speculating details because I feel like we can do that in a minute. But I think this last statement by Major DeWitt just indicates, unfortunately, that he thought that the people that should be rescuing him knew where he was and just decided not to do anything. Right. Which is such an unfortunate mindset to have in the imminent hours before death.
Oh,
of just like, I've been deserted and left behind. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yep.
It's just a really horrible, horrible last few hours. Finally, on May 9th, with the sandstorm subsiding, which that would be day five. So that was 5 days later. This is when the sandstorm is finally subsiding. And squadron leader Warren, after 5.5 hours of flying, spotted the Blenheim Z7513 and landed nearby. There, he found the bodies of the crew, Lieutenant J.H. Pinar, Lieutenant F.J. Reed, and Assistant Sergeant W.W. Oliver, lying in the shade of one of the wings. With him, he had a medical officer who diagnosed death by exposure and thirst, likely on the previous day. So that would have been May 8th, which would have been day four of being stranded.
Mm-hmm.
They found two empty water bottles, which I don't know how big those were, a 10-liter tin, but no rations. A first aid kit had been broken into, and they'd gotten into the morphine capsules. They also had gotten into this Gentia Violet, which, have you heard of Gentia Violet before?
Yeah, I have. I can't tell you why, but remind me.
Well, it's an antiseptic and antifungal, and it was over the bodies of the three deceased. They thought that it was probably used to reduce the pain of sunburn.
Oh.
Just a suspicion.
Yep.
The fire extinguishers were empty, and the hand-bearing compass had been removed, and the alcohol was gone. There was no fuel in the tank of the aircraft. There was not a navigator's logbook found, but Squadron Leader Warren found a rough pencil sketch of a map with a prominent hill feature and two coordinates of 213 and 233 degrees. And he used this information to infer where the other two planes may have been. He was unsuccessful on that day, but the following day, four other airplanes were assisting Warren in his search efforts. On May 11th, they went to the Blenheim they had already found. They used that kind of as their starting point and their reference. And they had two bomb bays, which did square searches in areas previously examined, which you recently talked about square searches on the episode about Eddie Rickenbacker, right? And then there was another plane search between the found Blenheim and Tizerbow, which was one of the areas they were flying over. Then squadron leader Warren continued to look for the other Blenheims. He had many failed attempts, but finally he was able to find the other two Blenheims that were nose to nose at the bottom of a hill. And as he approached for landing, air mechanic Jewel stumbled out of the shade of one of these wings of the plane. He was too weak to fire his pistol. He took a few steps towards the rescuers and just collapsed.
Collapsed dead or collapsed
no,
alive?
No, he was still alive. Collapsed alive.
Thank goodness.
Oh, I know, goodness. Right? Like, oh my goodness, I can't believe that he could even stand.
Yeah.
And Jewel was flown to Kufra for medical attention. He later testified at the inquiry into the incident, and that's where they got a lot of the information about what happened, what attempts were made. Unfortunately, due to the timing of the incident, I was not able to find any information about what happened to this air mechanic following the incident, you know, how he survived while the others perished or what happened to him after the fact. I'm sure that information exists somewhere in the world. It just wasn't readily available. So I don't have a lot to add from his perspective.
So was he the sole survivor?
Sole survivor.
Mm.
And sadly, they found the remaining crew members lying under the wing, all apparently deceased since May 8th. So only 4 days in. And so this is the 11th.
Yeah, so he was by himself for 3 days.
Yeah.
Those are some harsh conditions. I mean, I can think of few places short of like a, you know, freezing blizzard or I guess a hot sandstorm where you can't kind of hang out for 5 or 6 days with several liters of water and survive. But man.
Right. I mean, that is literally against all odds.
Yeah.
So the deceased were Major DeWitt, two lieutenants, J.S. DeToy, L.T.H. Wessels, and then Lieutenant H. Pinar, Sergeant A.D. Voss, and S.C. Shipman, and Air Mechanics R.J. Swanepoel and C.F. Van Breda. Some of the men had what were assumed to be self-inflicted gunshot wounds.
Okay, there you have it.
There you have it. Three revolvers were found without ammunition. One of the revolvers was found in the hand of Major DeWitt, but there was no mention in any of the documents that I found that stated whether or not he had a gunshot or whether he killed himself.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that was out of posterity or just like protecting his status as, you know, the leader of this crew. I don't know.
Yeah.
There were 21 empty water bottles, one containing urine, and 3 empty half-gallon tins found alongside of them with considerable amount of unused emergency rations. The oil from sardine tins and the syrup from canned fruit had been consumed. All but one first aid kit had been opened, though it seemed that only the gentian violet had been used. And in these instances, they didn't use any of the morphine capsules. All of that was intact. There were some fire extinguishers that had been broken into and drained of liquid. Most of the oxygen bottles were empty. One pilot's compass and both bomb sight compasses had been broken into and the alcohol was gone. It appeared that the aircraft had taken off and landed several times at this location. 3 revolvers were found, all of them fired with the ammunition expended. And again, one revolver still in the hand of Major DeWitt. It just highlighted the desperateness of the situation that these men faced. 2 of the men that had passed away had broken into the compasses and drank the compass alcohol, despite it being poisonous.
Mm.
So the alcohol used in compasses is typically ethanol, which is ethyl alcohol. Ethanol is the same type of alcohol found in alcoholic beverages, but the ethanol used in compasses and other industrial or laboratory equipment can be denatured, meaning it has additives to make it poisonous, bad tasting, foul smelling, nauseating, to discourage recreational consumption.
Yes, I've used it as fuel for a camp stove, denatured alcohol, and that makes a lot of sense. Because you can just, you know, you just buy it. You don't have to be 21 or of drinking age because it's not consumable.
Correct. The immediate effects of drinking ethanol, especially if denatured, can lead to nausea and vomiting, dizziness, headaches. Obviously, even small amounts can cause these symptoms due to the added chemicals. And then you can get toxicity because it's highly toxic and it can lead to severe poisoning, cause symptoms like confusion, incoordination, stupor, possible coma. It also can cause liver and kidney damage. And, you know, ingesting a significant amount of denatured alcohol can be fatal. And what I thought was interesting is in both instances, in the plane that was isolated from these other two Blenheims, they'd gotten into all of the same things.
Yeah.
Aside from the fact that the first plane had gotten into the morphine, which makes complete sense.
I know. I'm surprised the rest of them didn't get into the morphine. I suppose they were going after the alcohol probably because it was liquid and they were thirsty and versus, you know, wanting to dull their pain. But the morphine would have been helpful for dulling the pain.
No kidding. The first aircraft, you know, they had gotten into the alcohol in these compasses. I have no idea, like, how much alcohol is actually in one of these compasses.
It's got to be a really small amount.
It can't be.
Yeah, it's got to
right.
be just a teaspoon or something.
But, you know, if it's toxic and poisonous, I'm sure it's not going to help the situation to ingest something like that when you're already dehydrated.
Yeah.
At one point, some of these men used fire extinguishers on either themselves or one another to cool themselves off. And this caused significant skin injuries.
Mm.
And that just makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. I'm sure that they were just doing anything. That alone tells you how desperate the situation
yeah.
is. At the point at which you're spraying a fire extinguisher on yourself to cool off, you know, things are looking bleak at that point.
Yeah.
And then you're suffering the effects of the skin injury relating to spraying it on your skin to begin with.
Right. Yeah. And I'll say, you know, the skin is our thermoregulating organ. And if you're damaging the skin, your ability to cool down when you're hot or stay warm when you're cold is impaired. So that would have absolutely worsened their heat challenge.
Right. And you have to wonder a little bit if the people who ingested the Compass alcohol were, in fact, also the individuals who decided to use the fire extinguishers, because potentially it wouldn't take a whole lot to alter your mental status and sure. make you think that there are certain things that are not good ideas.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, like, absolutely. And it makes me wonder, those might be the same ones that use the revolvers as well, like just a chain of events of bad or, you know, more kind of altered mental status based decision making that ultimately led to their death.
Right. The search party made preparations to bury the dead, and Lieutenant Colonel Borkenhagen visited the site of the Blenheims, and he read the final rites of the burial service. He recalled that, quote, is a very emotional experience. And after the service, the personal effects of the deceased were handed to the officer commanding, and the parties returned to Kufra. The inquiry into the incident took place in Kufra from June 1st to the 4th of 1942, and the board attributed the cause of the incident to several factors, including the crew's lack of experience in desert flying, the failure to maintain accurate navigation logs, and lapses in communication by the wireless operators during the flight. They placed the responsibility for forced landing on the crew of the leading aircraft, Z-7513, piloted by Major DeWitt.
Hmm.
Furthermore, the inquiry found that the ground and air searches failed due to the lack of accurate information about the aircraft's possible positions, challenging terrain, the disruptive sandstorm, and additionally problems with the aircraft that were unfit for search missions and poor signal organization hindered the search efforts. But the inquiry also noted that the stranded crews did little to aid the searchers, and they didn't engage in effective direction-finding procedures. They neglected visual signals and smudge fires after landing, so they could have done things to make themselves more visible than just shooting their guns, right?
Mm-hmm.
The inquiry identified reasons for the early deaths of the stranded aviators, including their failure to understand the severity of the situation. And they delayed in rationing water. They did risky behaviors, like we talked about, consuming the Compass alcohol, using the fire extinguishers for relief from the heat, resulting in painful injuries. They just had a lack of survival knowledge, which just it further exacerbated their plight against the desert. To prevent a recurrence of these type of incidents, the board made some comprehensive recommendations regarding the equipment to be carried on the aircraft flying over the desert, you know, some emergency procedures for forced landings. They also advised that only experienced crews should operate from Kufra, which is unfortunately, you know, sometimes these bad things have to happen before you really lay down the law.
Yeah.
I mean, from the beginning, it makes sense just to have people that are familiar with desert flying, but I guess sometimes you might not have the personnel. You know, you might just need somebody in the air. So.
Right. Yeah. Especially in wartime situation, like you were taking what you can get in a lot of situations, maybe under-resourced.
Exactly. Interestingly, Major DeWitt had previously earned the nickname Off-Course-Yani after leading his flight off course in the ferry battles due to instrument damage and disorientation, which adds a strange twist of irony to the situation and kind of makes you question his directional abilities.
Yeah, that's a little bit of foreshadowing in his life trajectory.
Yeah. The search parties lay to rest the three men found with the Z-7513 near the plane, and the eight men that were discovered around the Z-7610 and T-2252 were buried at the site where they were found. And in February 1959, a geological survey team stumbled upon Z-7513, which led to the exhumation and reburial of its three crewmen, Knightsbridge War Cemetery in Libya. And the remains of the eight men found with the Z-7610 and T-2252 were left in their original burial place until 1963, when they were also exhumed and then buried in Knightsbridge as well, which is kind of interesting. You would think that these families would want the bodies of their loved ones.
Back in South Africa. Yeah.
Yeah.
I also think about who's responsible for coordinating that operation of exhuming these men and transporting them. That's got to be a rough one.
Right. And if you're not going to return the body to their homeland, why move them at all? Unless you want to put up some tribute or something, I suppose.
What are the chances that the family is going to fly out to Libya? Well, as for the aircraft recovery, in May 1942, the Z-7610 and the T-2252 underwent repairs and they were flown back to Kufra. But 2252 later suffered engine failure again and crashed near Kufra. And the Z-7610 continued to serve with the number 15th Squadron Detachment at Kufra until November 27, 1942, when the detachment returned to the squadron. By then, the squadron had transitioned into a different type of aircraft, and so that aircraft was left behind at Kufra for repairs for the Royal Air Force Maintenance Unit. And then it ended up going to Sudan later on.
Okay.
And one of the other crafts at the time, the Z-7513, was deemed unserviceable and was abandoned in the desert. So only two out of the three planes were recovered. One of them, the engine failed again, and the other one was used for service until they moved on to better aircrafts, essentially.
So just like the ocean is full of shipwrecks, I wonder how many abandoned aircraft there are in the desert. Probably
a lot. Yeah. To summarize, these aircrafts carried inadequate supplies, ultimately, for survival in the harsh desert conditions. And the tragedy underscores the critical importance of thorough planning and preparation for unforeseen mishaps. You know, like ensuring sufficient water rations and discussing strategies for managing emergencies before they occur. And with better foresight and planning, tragedies like the one at Kufra could have been potentially avoided. But again, navigation in that time, I'm sure, was way more complicated. And we have to consider the fact that flying over the desert in a lot of ways is like flying over the ocean when there's very few landmarks to go by. So it's just an unfortunate series of events, really, at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's such a good point. There's so many similarities between this story and the story of Eddie Rickenbacker and his crew that had, you know, some navigation errors with the same type of systems over the Pacific Ocean, trying to pinpoint a tiny island in a vast ocean and missing it and all of the tragedy that unfolded because of it. A lot of parallels.
The difference, I think, is that Eddie Rickenbacker really held his own. He had a very different approach in a time of tragedy and uncertainty. And he was able to think it through and not panic. And it just goes to show you how a little bit of forethought or just even the ability to remain calm in a difficult situation can really ultimately determine a life or death outcome.
Right. Yeah.
It can be the slightest change in the way that you think about the situation that can either lead to your survival or demise.
Right. Yeah. The mental component is so important.
Absolutely.
And they didn't have access to revolvers.
That's true. Such a good point. It's an easy out. It kind of reminded me of, you know, you're talking about those aircrafts not having parachutes on them.
Yeah.
I recently saw my grandfather in Missoula. This was 2 weeks ago for his 99.5 birthday.
Oh, that's so and cool.
I know. He flew a bomber, a B-52 bomber in World War II. And I asked him about that. I said, hey, were there parachutes in your aircraft? And he was like, yes, there were definitely parachutes. And he said that the seats in the B-52 bomber were enormous. They were almost made for like really tall people. And all of these people that were fighter pilots ended up being really tall. All these tall guys flying in these teeny tiny seats. The fighter pilots were like crunched in their airplanes. And in the B-52, he said, you had to have like your backpack and all of these things behind you. So you weren't just floating around in your seat space. But he's full of stories.
I bet. Oh,
he's
man.
He's had some interesting things happen.
We should interview him.
Oh, my gosh.
He's a survivor.
He's a little hard of hearing. But I think that we could do it if I had a list of questions for him to answer.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, how many World War II pilots are left on this planet?
Not many.
Very many.
Yeah. Did you ask him if he knew of Eddie Rickenbacker?
Yeah, he had heard about it. It's just amazing that he still has complete cognition. You know, I can text him and he'll respond.
That is incredible.
Mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Yes. So anyway.
Shout out to...
We should definitely interview him. Shout out to Dick Moore.
Shout out to Dick Moore. Yep.
Anyway, that's a wrap for today. Thank you for listening. I hope that that wasn't too much drudgery, you know, reliving some history that happened in 1942. But there's some really interesting things that happened in the past, and we take for granted how much technology we have at our fingertips now. You know, like, it's just a completely different world when we have access to information, and we just need to appreciate that.
Yeah. Nowadays, you hear about pilots, you know, inputting their destination and then falling asleep and then overshooting it because they slept through. Just turn the plane around, go back. Yeah. We live in a different world.
Totally, totally different world. Thanks for listening to the Crux True Survival Stories. And I just wanted to mention that and announce that we've joined a new network called the Believe Podcasting Network. Don't worry, you'll be able to access all of our content the same way that you would otherwise. But I just wanted to mention that. We're really excited that the Believe Network has asked us to join them and that they believe in us. That's great. If you have a survival story, any comments, questions, or topics of discussion, feel free to reach out at thecruxsurvival@gmail.com or on Instagram at thecruxpodcast. And our email and Instagram details will be in the show description, so it's easy to find. We're considering adding a mailbag episode, and we would love for your input and any participation. Thank you once again for listening. I hope you have a wonderful week. All right, Julie, have a great rest of your day and a great rest of your week.
You too. Thanks, Casey. Thanks for a good one.
Back to school means lots of food changes, from daily multis to belly-balancing probiotics. Ollie's got your fam covered. Do wellness on your terms. Find Ollie at a store near you or at OLLY.com.
Ollie!
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Hey, it's Michelle Beadle. That's right, the Michelle Beadle. You're welcome. You love talking about sports. I love talking about sports. You know the only thing cooler than talking about sports? Sports! And right now, all your favorite sports are on SiriusXM. I'm talking every NFL game, every game from the NBA, NHL, MLB, every NASCAR race, golf major, major conference college sports, and all the top games in the WNBA. If it gets your heart pumping, it's on SiriusXM. To start your free trial of SiriusXM today, visit SiriusXM.com/believe.